Day after day the wind held fair, and the rowers pulled with a will, singing over the oars, their high spirits abounding, their arms and backs indefatigable, as Nakonto's nephews guided them unerringly through the channels. Each day at noon Taita climbed to the top of the mast to scan the country ahead. Long before he expected it, he picked out far ahead the shapes of the first trees above the interminable papyrus. Under the keels of the galleys the Nile grew deeper, and the reed-beds on either side opened out. At last they burst out of the great sud, and ahead lay the prodigious plains through which the Nile ran, like a long green python, until it disappeared into the dusty haze of distance. They moored the galleys under the steep-cut bank. While Tinnat and his men were setting up the first camp on dry land for many a long day, they unloaded the horses. A league away across the dusty plain, a herd of 8 giraffes was browsing in a clump of flat-topped acacia trees. "We have had no fresh meat since we left the Shilluk," Taita told Tinnat. "Everyone will be pleased to eat something other than catfish. I propose to take out a hunting party. Once they have finished building the zariba, let the people rest and disport themselves." Taita, Merin, and the 2 girls strung their bows, mounted, and set off in pursuit of the long-necked, dappled beasts. The horses were as glad as their riders to be ashore. They stretched out their necks and whisked their tails as they tore across the open ground. The giraffe saw them, coming from afar off, forsook the protection of the acacia trees, and broke into a ponderous rocking gallop across the plain. Their long tails, with tufted black tips, curled back over their haunches, and their legs on each side swung forward together so that they appeared to be moving away only slowly. However, the hunters had to push the horses to their top speed to overhaul them. As they came up behind them, they rode into the dust cloud thrown up by the giraffe's hooves, and were forced to slit their eyes to prevent them being blinded. Taita picked out a half-grown bull calf lagging near the rear of the herd, whose flesh would be sufficient to feed the entire party, and, just as important, tender and succulent. "That's the one we want!" he shouted, as he pointed it out to the others. As they closed with the animal, Taita drew and shot his first arrow into the back of its leg, aiming to sever the great tendon and cripple it. The giraffe staggered and almost fell, but regained its balance and ploughed on, but at a hampered pace, heavily favouring the wounded limb. Taita signalled to the others. They split into 2 pairs and pressed in on each side of the animal. From a range of only a few yards, they shot arrow after arrow into its heaving chest. They were trying to drive through into its heart and lungs, but the skin was as tough as a war shield, and the vital organs lay deep inside. Bleeding heavily, the beast ran on, swishing its tail and uttering a soft grunt of pain as each arrowhead thumped into it. The riders edged their mounts closer and closer to shorten the range and make their arrows tell more effectively. Sedudu was slightly behind Merin, and he had not noticed how recklessly she was riding in on the quarry until he glanced over his shoulder. "Too close!" he yelled at her. "Sheer away, Sedudu!" But the warning came too late. The giraffe bucked and lashed out at her with its back leg, a mighty kick that made her mount shy. Sedudu lost her seat and was thrown over its head. She fell heavily and rolled in a cloud of dust almost under the giraffe's hooves. It loosed a second kick at her that would have shattered her skull had it landed square, but instead it flew over her head. When at last she stopped rolling and sliding, she lay deathly still on the ground. Merin turned his own horse back immediately and jumped down. As he ran to where she lay, she sat up groggily and gave an uncertain laugh. "The ground is harder than it looks." Gingerly she felt her temples. "And my head is softer than I thought." Neither Taita nor Fen had seen her fall, and raced on after the giraffe. "Our arrows are not penetrating deep enough to kill him," Taita shouted across at her. "I must bring him down with the sword." "Don't risk your neck," Fen shouted anxiously, but he ignored the warning and kicked his feet free of the stirrups. "Take Windsmoke's head," he told her, and tossed the reins to her. Then he drew the sword from the scabbard that hung between his shoulder blades and vaulted to the ground. He used the momentum of the mare's gallop to throw himself forward so that for a brief space he was able to match the speed of the giraffe. With each pace, its huge rear hoof swung higher than his head, and he ducked under it. But as the giraffe planted its nearest hoof and placed its weight upon it, the tendon stood out proud beneath the dappled skin as it came under pressure. It was as thick as Taita's wrist. On the run, he took a double-handed grip on the sword hilt and swung the blade hard, aiming to sever the tendon just above the hock. He caught it, and it parted with a rubbery snapping sound. The leg collapsed, and the giraffe went down, sliding on its haunches. It tried to heave itself upright again, but the leg was crippled. Instead, it overbalanced and rolled onto its side. For a moment, its neck was stretched out along the ground and within his reach. Taita sprang forward and stabbed the point into the neck, neatly parting the joint in the vertebra. Then he jumped back as the giraffe kicked again convulsively. Then all four of its legs stiffened and were still. Its eyelids quivered, and the lashes meshed shut over the huge eyes. As Taita stood over the carcass, Fenn rode up to him, leading Windsmoke. "You were so quick!" Her voice was filled with awe. "Like a peregrine on a pigeon." She jumped down and ran to him, her hair in a wind tangle, her lovely face flushed with the thrill of the chase. "And you are so lovely you astonish my eyes each time I look at you." He held her at arm's length to study her face. "How could you believe for a moment that I would ever leave you?" "We will speak more of this later. But here come Merin and Sidudu." Merin had recaptured Sidudu's horse, and she was mounted again. As she came nearer, they saw that her bodice was ripped and that her breasts bounced free. She was coated with dust, and there were twigs in her hair. One cheek was grazed, but she was smiling. "Ho, Fenn!" she shouted. "Was that not rich sport?" The four rode to the nearest clump of acacia trees and dismounted in the shade to rest the horses. They passed the water-skin round, and when they had slaked their thirst, Sidudu slipped her tunic over her shoulders and stood naked to allow Taita to assess her injuries. It did not take long. "Put on your tunic again, Sidudu. You have broken no bones," he assured her. "All you need is a bathe in the river. Your bruises will fade in a few days. Now, Fenn and I have something of great moment to discuss with you and Merin." This was the true reason that Taita had taken the pair out hunting. He wanted them alone so that he could inform them of his plans. The sun had passed its noon before he allowed Merin and Sidudu to return to the river where the flotilla waited for them. By then their mood had changed. They were worried and unhappy. "Promise that you will not go away for all time," Sidudu embraced Fenn fervently. "To me you are dearer than any sister could ever be. I could not bear to lose you." "Although you will not see us, Taita and I will be with you. It is just small magic. You have seen it done many times before," Fenn assured her. Then Merin spoke out. "I trust your good sense, Magus, although it seems that there is a great deal less of that than there once was. I remember a time when it was you who always cautioned me to prudence. Now it is I who must play nursemaid to you. It is strange how reckless a man becomes when something dangles between his legs." Taita laughed. "Ha ha! A wise observation, good Merin. But do not worry yourself unduly. Fenn and I know what we are about. Go back to the boats and play your part." Merin and Sidudu rode off towards the river, but kept turning in their saddles to look back anxiously. They waved farewell a dozen times before they were out of sight. "Now we must set the scene for our disappearance," Taita told Fenn. And they went to fetch their rolled sleeping mats, which were tied behind the saddles. In the bedrolls they had brought with them fresh clothing. They stripped off their dusty, sweat-stained tunics and stood for a moment to enjoy the breeze upon their naked bodies. Taita stooped to pick up his clean tunic, but Fenn stopped him. "There is no great hurry, my lord. It will be some time before the others return to search for us. We should take advantage of this moment, and that we are unencumbered by our clothing. When Merin reports our demise to Tinat, the whole company will race here to find our remains. They might arrive to find us very much alive. Fenn reached down between his legs. Do you recall what Merrin said about this? How it makes a man reckless? Well, I propose that we be reckless together. When you hold me like that, you could lead me anywhere, and I would make no protest. She smiled slyly and sank down on her knees before him. What are you doing now? He demanded. This is something you never learnt from me. Imbali gave me precise instructions, but hush now, my lord. I will not be able to reply to any more questions. My mouth will be otherwise engaged. They cut the matter fine, and were only just able to complete setting the stage for their subterfuge before they saw the dust of galloping horses approaching from the direction of the river. They moved back into the grove of acacias and sat quietly together at the base of a tree. They held each other's hands and wove round themselves a spell of concealment. The hammering of hooves grew louder until Tinnat and Merrin appeared out of the dust cloud, riding hard at the head of a large band of armed men. As soon as they saw Windsmoke and Whirlwind grazing at the edge of the grove, they swerved towards them and came up only 20 paces from where Taita and Fenn were sitting. "Oh, by the guts and liver of Seth!" Merrin cried. "See the blood upon the saddles? It is even as I told you. The Jinni have seized them and carried them away." The dark stains were giraffe blood, but Tinnat was not to know that. "By the coupling of Isis and Osiris, this is a tragic business." He swung down from the saddle. "Search the area for any sign of the Magus and his consort." Within a short time they had discovered Taita's ripped, blood-stained tunic. Merrin held it in both hands and buried his face in it. "Taita has been taken from us. I am a son without a father," he sobbed. "I fear that good Merrin is overplaying his part," Taita whispered to Fenn. "I never suspected such talent in him," she agreed. "He would be superb as Horus in the temple pageant." "How can we go back to Pharaoh and tell him that we allowed Taita to be taken?" Tinnat lamented. "We must at least find his body." "I told you, Colonel Tinnat. I saw them both taken up into the sky by the Jinni," Merrin tried to dissuade him. Tinnat, though, was dogged and determined. "Nonetheless, we must continue our search. We must comb every inch of the grove," he insisted. Once again the men spread out in an extended line and advanced through the trees. Merrin and Tinnat were in the lead, and Merrin walked within arm's length of where they sat. His face was set in a formidable frown, and he muttered to himself under his breath, "Come now, Tinnat, don't be so pig-headed. Let us go back to the boats and leave the Magus to his tricks." At that moment there was a shout as a searcher found Fenn's blood-stained tunic. Merrin hurried to him, and they heard him arguing with Tinnat, trying to persuade him to abandon the search. Presented with the evidence of the bloody garments, Tinnat at last gave in. They took Windsmoke and Whirlwind and rode back to the carcass of the giraffe to butcher it and carry away the meat to the boats. Taita and Fenn stood up, picked up their weapons and wandered away towards the north, angling back to meet the Nile again far downstream. "I do so love being alone with you," Fenn said dreamily. "Shall we stop and rest again under the shade of that tree? It seems I have awakened in you the sleeping dragon." "I have discovered that my little dragon never sleeps," she assured him. "She is always wide awake and ready to play. I hope she does not weary you, my lord." Taita led her to the trees. "It will be pleasantly diverting to see who will first weary whom," said he.